Before we get started, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Yeah, definitely check them out.
If you're gearing up for the Series 99, they've got a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing.
Which is super helpful.
Right. You can check it out at CertFuel.com. All right, let's get into it. You know, usually when we talk about finance, people picture the trading
Oh
floor,
yeah, the shouting, the flashing
the
screen.
millions of dollars moving in a heartbeat.
Right, the glamorous, adrenaline-fueled Hollywood version of Wall Street.
But behind every single one of those lightning fast trades, there is a massive, intricate machine that actually makes it happen, and that is operations.
The plumbing.
Exactly. It's
Okay.
the absolute backbone of finance. It's what turns a customer's request into reality. If operations fail, the whole system just grinds to a halt.
It really does.
And today, our mission is mastering the exact mechanisms that make that machine run. We're talking account opening, maintenance, and asset movement, specifically for the Series 99 exam.
Which is a notoriously tricky area. I mean, the exam doesn't just test if you know the definitions.
Right.
It tests your ability to distinguish between incredibly similar concepts.
Yeah, like you have to know the difference between a rollover and a transfer.
Exactly. Or between an account restriction and a freeze.
Or the exact retention clocks for different pieces of paper, which is a headache.
It's all about the details. But more importantly, it's about understanding why those details exist.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if we just memorize the rule, it falls out of our brains the second we close the book.
Exactly, yeah.
But if we understand the mechanism, we can reason our way through a curveball question. So let's start at the very first step of the process.
The front door.
The front door. You cannot service an account until you know exactly who is standing there. We have to identify and categorize the customer. And the anchor for this entire process is something called the CIP, the Customer Identification Program.
Exactly. And to really understand the CIP, we need a tiny bit of history.
Okay, take us back.
After 9/11, the Patriot Act dramatically overhauled how financial institutions look at anti-money laundering and terrorist financing.
Right, things got way stricter.
The CIP is a direct result of that. The government essentially said, you can no longer just take someone's word for it.
You actually have to check.
Yeah, you need a formalized, risk-based procedure to form a reasonable belief that you know the true identity of every single customer.
And that boils down to what we can call the core four. There are four specific things we absolutely need before we can open an account.
Yep, the big four.
We need their name. We need their date of birth. If they are an individual, we need a physical address,
Not a P.O. box, right?
right? A physical one. And an identification number, which for a U.S. person is a taxpayer identification number or TIN.
Usually a social security number for a person or an employer identification number for a business.
Okay, so that is the absolute baseline. The firm has to collect those four items before opening the account.
You do, yeah.
But let's pressure test this. Let's introduce a character we're going to use throughout this deep dive. Let's call him Frank the Founder.
I like Frank already.
Frank is starting a business. Frank's Flapjack Foundry.
Delicious.
He has his state formation papers. He has a check from an angel investor, and he needs to open a corporate bank account today to deposit that money.
Okay, high stakes.
But he just applied for his employer identification number on the IRS website, and the system is delayed. He doesn't actually have the TIN in his hand yet.
Ah, classic problem.
Okay, listener, think about this. What if a customer just applied for a TIN but doesn't have the number yet? Can we open the account?
Let's give him a second to think about it.
Take a beat. My immediate assumption is, tough luck, Frank. The core four is the law. We have to turn him away. Is that right?
It's a very logical assumption, but it's actually incorrect.
Really?
And this is a classic exam trap. There is the very specific limited exception built into the CIP rules.
So we can help Frank out.
You can open the account for Frank, yes. But only if the firm confirms that he applied for that identification number before the account was opened.
Wait, so the application just have to be in flight?
Exactly. The regulators recognize that the real world is messy.
Right, the IRS website crashes.
Exactly. New businesses or even new immigrants who just got their paperwork, they might need to function financially while waiting for the bureaucracy to catch up.
That makes total sense.
But, and this is crucial, Frank can't just promise to apply for it later.
I'll do it tomorrow, I swear.
Right, the firm has to actually confirm the application precedes the account opening.
It's a pragmatic loophole, but a tight one. Okay, so we've collected Frank's information. We have his name, his business address, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
But having a piece of paper with information on it doesn't mean we actually trust it.
Definitely not.
There has to be a clear wedge between collecting the data and verifying that the data is real.
A massive wedge. And the exam will test you on the timeline of that wedge.
Okay, lay it out.
Collection happens before opening. Verification happens within a reasonable time before or after opening.
Okay. Let's put these side by side. Collection before, verification can be after. So I don't necessarily have to verify everything the second he walks in.
No, you can collect, open the account, and then verify.
Why the delay? I mean, why not demand instant verification?
Again, real-world logistics. Sometimes you use non-documentary methods to verify someone.
Like running a background check.
Right. You run their name against a credit bureau, or you use a third-party database. And maybe that database is down for maintenance.
Oh, sure.
Or maybe you need them to mail in a physical utility bill. If the rule required instant, flawless verification before the account could even exist, commerce would just slow to a crawl.
It would be a nightmare. So you collect first, verify second.
Exactly.
And that verification can be documentary, like handing over a driver's license or a passport.
Yep.
Or non-documentary, like pinging that credit bureau. But let's stick with Frank the founder.
Okay, back to the flapjacks.
Frank isn't opening a personal account. He's opening an entity account for the Flapjack Foundry. We collect the documents, the business license, the articles of incorporation.
Right.
But a business is just a piece of paper. It's a legal fiction. How do we know who is actually pulling the strings?
That's the million-dollar question.
Do we have to run full background checks on Frank and his entire board of directors just to open a corporate account?
This is where a lot of people get tripped up on the exam. Digging into the individuals who control the entity has a strict only when condition.
Only when?
You only dig into the control persons if the standard documentary and non-documentary methods fail to verify the entity's true identity.
So it's an escalation protocol. It's not the default setting.
Precisely. Think about it from a scale perspective. Mm-hmm. If Apple comes in to open an account, you aren't going to demand the passports of every single person in the C-suite.
No, that would be ridiculous.
Right. You verify the corporation through public records and standard documents.
But what if it's a sketchy setup?
Exactly. If Frank's Flapjack Foundry is registered to a P.O. box in a high-risk jurisdiction, and the corporate documents look like they were printed on a dot matrix printer from 1995.
Red flags everywhere.
Well, now your standard methods are falling short. That is when the rule requires you to escalate and figure out who the actual humans are behind the shell.
Okay, so we escalate, we start digging, but what happens if verification just flat out fails?
It happens.
Let's say Frank's documents are totally forged. The database comes back completely red. I always imagine this scenario where alarms start blaring in the branch.
Oh boy.
The doors lock automatically, and a SWAT team drops from the ceiling to haul a customer away. Account closed immediately.
I hate to ruin the cinematic action movie in your head, but there are no SWAT teams.
Darn it.
And surprisingly, a failed verification does not automatically require you to close the account.
Wait, pause the tape. It doesn't? If I know a guy is failing identity verification, why wouldn't I instantly close the account?
Think about the underlying goal here. The whole point is catching bad actors.
Okay, yeah.
If you instantly close the account and hand a money launderer their money back, you've just tipped them off.
Oh.
They're going to take their funds and disappear into the wind before law enforcement even knows they exist.
That makes so much sense. If I slam the door in their face, I ruin the investigation.
Exactly. Instead of a blanket rule demanding instant closure, the SEC requires the firm's written customer identification program to outline response procedures.
Okay, what kind of procedures?
They have to cover four specific decisions. First, when to refuse to open the account at all.
Just say no up front.
Second, what the terms are for conducting transactions while the firm continues trying to verify the identity.
Like maybe you restrict withdrawals but allow deposits.
Exactly. Third, when to actually close the account after attempts have definitively failed.
Right.
And fourth, when to file a suspicious activity report or a SAR with the government.
That is fascinating. So the key takeaway for the exam is that failed verification triggers the firm's written procedures. It does not trigger an automatic mandatory closure.
Spot on. Look out for the word written in those answer choices.
Good tip. Okay, let's clear Frank's name. The Flapjack Foundry is a legitimate business. His verification passes with flying colors.
Good for Frank.
We've identified him. Now we have to categorize his account. Frank's business is legally structured as a corporation. He's got the Inc. at the end of his name.
Yep.
So if I'm looking at a Series 99 question and I see a corporate account, my instinct is to categorize that as an institutional customer.
A lot of people do.
Does a corporate registration automatically equal institutional status?
No. It's a very common misconception, but the answer is an absolute no.
Why not?
Registration and customer category answer entirely different questions. Registration just tells us the legal wrapper.
Who holds the account?
Right, in this case, the corporation.
Yeah.
But the customer category, whether they are retail or institutional, is determined by their assumed level of financial sophistication and assets.
Because the regulators want to know how much protection to give them, right? Like, yeah, a massive hedge fund doesn't need the same handholding as my grandmother.
Exactly. To be considered an institutional customer, Frank needs to hit specific criteria.
Like what?
Usually that means having at least $50 million in total assets, or being a specified financial institution, like a bank or a registered investment advisor.
Wow, $50 million is a steep hill.
It is. Just having ink on the paperwork doesn't magically bestow financial genius upon him.
Right.
If Frank's Flapjacks is a startup with $50,000 in the bank, the regulators view him as a retail customer who just happens to have a corporate registration.
So he gets full retail protections.
He does.
Okay. Registration is the wrapper. Category is the size and sophistication. Now, while we are talking about categories, there's a term that always floats around in these exam questions.
Oh, let me guess.
Prime brokerage. Is prime brokerage a third customer category? Like retail, institutional, and prime?
No. And the exam loves to use it as a distractor, exactly like that. Prime brokerage is not an identity. It is a clearing and settlement arrangement.
Okay, it's a service. How does that actually work mechanically?
Imagine a massive hedge fund. They want to execute trades all over Wall Street to get the best prices.
Sure, they're shopping around.
They might buy tech stocks through Morgan Stanley and short oil stocks through Goldman Sachs. But they don't want to manage 50 different accounts with 50 different balances.
That would be an administrative nightmare.
Furthermore, they want to keep their overall strategy a secret from any single broker. So they set up a prime brokerage arrangement.
Okay.
They trade wherever they want. Those are the executing brokers. But at the end of the day, all those trades settle and clear into one central account at their prime broker.
So the prime broker is like the master custodian. They hold the assets, provide the consolidated margin loans, and do the massive administrative heavy lifting.
Exactly.
While the executing brokers just do the actual buying and selling.
You nailed it. It's a highly complex service arrangement used by substantial retail or institutional clients. But it is not a customer type in and of itself.
Perfect. So let's transition from the front door to the filing cabinet. We know who Frank is. We know he's a retail corporate client. We haven't triggered any AML alarms.
So far, so good.
Now, operations actually has to build and maintain his permanent record. And this introduces a whole new set of regulatory headaches.
Oh, paper trails.
We hear these three terms thrown around constantly. The customer identification program, the account information requirements, and the know your customer rule.
They do sound really similar.
Yeah, they all sound like variations of learn about the guy, how do we keep them separate for the exam?
Which is why test writers love them.
Hmm.
But they serve entirely different purposes. We really need to compartmentalize them.
Let's build an analogy. Let's say our brokerage firm is an exclusive nightclub.
I like where this is going.
The CIP, the customer identification program, that is the bouncer standing outside and the cold checking Frank's ID.
The big guy with the clipboard.
Exactly. The bouncer has one singular job. Are you actually Frank? He checks the passport, shines a flashlight on the hologram, and checks the birth date.
That's true identity.
Right. The bouncer does not care what Frank likes to drink. He doesn't care how much money Frank makes. He just cares that the ID is real.
That's a great way to look at it. The CIP is strictly anti-fraud and anti-money laundering.
Then Frank gets past the bouncer and walks up to the membership desk. This is the account information.
The paperwork phase.
This is the basic administrative file the club keeps on him. What is his mailing address? Who is the specific employee at our firm assigned to handle his account?
Right, the logistics.
And crucially, has a manager sign the paperwork to officially accept his membership? This is about responsibility and internal acceptance.
It's the operational scaffolding of the account.
And finally, Frank sits down at the bar. This is Know Your Customer, or KYC.
The bartender.
The bartender knows Frank is allergic to peanuts. He knows he prefers his martinis dry. He knows his risk tolerance after a few drinks.
He knows the whole profile.
Exactly. KYC is about gathering the essential facts to service the account effectively, follow special handling instructions, understand his investment profile, and know the authority of anyone acting on his behalf.
It's the suitability engine.
Right.
And here is the exact trap the exam will lay for you. Completing the bouncer's job does not finish the bartender's job.
Oh, meaning what?
Meaning, completing identity verification under CIP does not complete your broader KYC obligation.
So I can't just say, well, his driver's license is real, so I guess I can sell him a complex derivatives package.
Exactly. You can know with 100% certainty who a person is
yeah.
and still have absolutely no idea what their investment profile is or what special handling instructions they require.
The obligations don't merge.
No, they are distinct regulatory checklists.
Okay, let's drill down into that account information piece, the membership desk.
Okay.
Let's say Frank designates his chief financial officer to do all the trading for the Flapjack Foundry account. Frank is busy making flapjacks. The CFO handles the money.
A standard setup.
Okay, listener, listen closely to this one. If that CFO signs the new account paperwork, does that CFO's signature mean the account is officially accepted and approved by our firm?
Give them a beat.
Think about it.
Take a beat and think about the liability here. If an account is being opened, the firm is taking on risk.
Right.
Does the customer's employee have the authority to bind your brokerage firm to that risk? Absolutely not.
Ah. So the list of people authorized to transact on an entity account is a totally separate record from the firm's internal account acceptance.
Completely separate. Account acceptance requires the signature of a partner, officer, or designated manager of the brokerage firm.
An internal boss.
Yes. That principal is signing off to say, I have reviewed this, and we, the firm, accept this customer under our policies.
And what does the CFO's signature mean?
The CFO's signature simply says, Frank gave me permission to buy stocks. External trading authority never, ever replaces internal firm acceptance.
That distinction between internal approval and external authority is huge.
It is.
Now, speaking of instructions and authority, what about standing settlement instructions? Do those prove identity or authority?
Not at all. Standing settlement instructions, or SSIs, are purely logistical plumbing.
Plumbing again.
Yeah. They are reusable directions for the operations team to handle settlement after a trade occurs.
Like an auto-pay setup?
Sort of. It's like telling your bank, every time my mortgage is due, pull the money from this specific routing number.
Oh, I see.
SSIs do not establish customer identity. They do not prove a person is legally authorized to transact. And they certainly don't replace the manager's acceptance signature.
They just tell the money where to go once a trade is done.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got the plumbing set up. The account is accepted. Now Frank wants to actually buy something.
Time to trade.
Depending on what he buys, we have to provide specific product disclosures. And the rule of thumb here is matching the document to its specific trigger.
That's the golden rule.
Let's say Frank wants to trade options. I'm assuming we can't just hand him a generic investing is risky pamphlet. Right.
No, the SEC is very prescriptive here. Options are inherently dangerous if you don't know what you're doing.
Right, you can lose everything.
For options, you must deliver the options disclosure document, commonly called the ODD.
The ODD.
And pay attention to the timing. The ODD must be delivered at or before the account is approved for options trading.
So it's a prerequisite?
The delivery is essentially a prerequisite condition for the approval itself. You can't approve first and deliver later.
Okay, so options trigger the ODD. I'm assuming that logic scales. If Frank decides options are too complicated and pivots to mutual funds, I need the specific prospectus for that exact fund, right?
Exactly. An ODD sitting in his file from last month does not satisfy the mutual fund requirement. The disclosure document must match the product being sold.
What if you buy something incredibly hard to sell? A highly illiquid security.
Okay, tricky one.
If the whole point is matching risk to disclosure, I'm imagining operations just has a stack of giant neon red stickers that say danger, highly illiquid, that they slap on the front of his file.
That would be visually striking.
Is there a universal warning document for anything illiquid?
While a neon sticker might be an effective visual deterrent, there is no such thing as a universal illiquid security disclosure document in the regulations.
So it's a trap.
It is. This is a trap designed to catch test takers who rely on common sense rather than the letter of the rule.
Right.
Illiquidity is a characteristic, but it alone does not dictate a specific standardized document.
So what do you do?
You still have to identify the actual specific product Frank bought. Maybe it's a non-traded REIT or limited partnership, and you provide the exact disclosure prospectus applicable to that specific product.
So no generic danger stickers.
Yeah.
Duly noted. All right, so Frank's file is built. The bouncer, the membership desk, and the bartender have all done their jobs.
Holy Trinity.
The manager signed it, disclosures are delivered. But paperwork ages. It sits in a file cabinet or on a server, getting older.
Gathering dust.
And regulators love to check if you are keeping things for the right amount of time. How long do we keep this paper?
Record retention is a heavily tested area, and it all revolves around understanding the 5 versus 6 rule.
5 versus 6.
The different types of records operate on entirely different clocks, mostly tied to the regulatory examination cycles and anti-money laundering statutes of limitations.
Let's do a side-by-side contrast here. Let's start with the bouncer's records. Identity verification, the CIP.
Identity records operate on a 5-year clock. But you have to pay attention to when the clock starts, because it depends on the specific item.
Okay, break it down.
The actual identifying information you collected,
yeah,
the name, address, DOBTIN, that data must be kept for 5 years after the account is closed.
After it's closed. So the data survives the account by 5 years. What about the photocopy of his driver's license?
That's different. The records of the documents you used to verify them, or the notes on the non-documentary methods you used, those are kept for 5 years after the record is made.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So if Frank keeps his account open for 30 years, I don't need to keep the photocopy of his 1996 driver's license for 35 years.
No, you don't.
It expires 5 years after I make the copy. Okay, so CIP is a 5-year world. What about the membership desk, the customer account information?
Account information operates on a 6-year clock. And here you have to track changes.
Changes.
Yeah. If a piece of information is updated, let's say Frank's Flapjack Foundry moves to a bigger warehouse and gives you a new address, you must preserve the old replaced address for 6 years after the update date.
So the old address is on a 6-year timer from the moment it becomes obsolete.
Correct. And for the final, current information sitting on the account when it eventually shuts down, you preserve that for 6 years after the account closes.
5 years for identity, 6 years for account info. And we need to do a quick vocabulary check here because the regulators are very particular about the words maintain versus preserve.
Very particular.
In normal English, they mean the same thing.
But not in compliance English.
Mm-hmm.
Maintain refers to information that is currently active and in use.
Like the current address.
Right. You maintain Frank's current address. Preserve refers to information that is no longer current, but you are required to hold on to it for the historical record.
You preserve his old, outdated address.
Exactly. Maintain the present, preserve the past.
Maintain the present, preserve the past. That's a great mnemonic. Okay, let's pivot slightly and introduce our next character.
Right.
We have Frank the customer. Let's introduce Diligent Dave. Dave works at our brokerage firm. He's an associated person and employee.
Hi, Dave.
He's a great guy, very diligent. But Dave wants to open a covered outside trading account at another competing brokerage firm down the street. Why do regulators care about where Dave trades?
They care deeply because of the inherent conflict of interest. Dave works inside the machine.
He has access.
He might see massive institutional block trades coming down the pipe or hear about a merger before it goes public.
Right.
If he can just quietly open an account at another firm and trade ahead of that information, what we call front running, that destroys market integrity.
He's basically cheating.
Right. So the rules tightly control how and when he can trade elsewhere.
So what are the actual rules for Dave? I assume it depends on when he opens the account. Let's say it's a brand new account. He wants to walk down the street tomorrow and open one.
For a new covered outside account, everything must happen in advance. Dave needs our firm's prior written consent to open it.
Prior written consent?
And he must notify the outside executing firm in writing about his association with our firm before the account is opened.
Before.
The logic is simple. The employer needs the chance to say no before any trades can happen.
That makes perfect sense for a new account. But what if Dave already had the account?
The timeline shifts.
Let's say Dave had a personal trading account at the other firm for 10 years, and then we hired him today. We can't go back in time and get prior consent for something he did a decade ago.
Exactly, which is why there's a timeline trap here for the exam. If the account was pre-existing, Dave has 30 calendar days after becoming associated with our firm to obtain our written consent to maintain the account.
30 days.
And to notify the outside firm in writing about his new employment status.
Okay, so new accounts require prior permission. Pre-existing accounts give you a 30-day grace period to get the paperwork in order.
Yeah.
Now, once the outside firm knows that Dave works for us, how does our compliance department monitor him? Do the outside brokers just automatically start mailing us copies of all his trade confirmations and monthly statements?
That is a huge misconception and a very common way to lose a point on the test.
So they don't.
They do not send anything automatically. The executing member, the outside firm, only sends duplicate confirmations and statements if Dave's employer requests them in writing.
Wow.
The flow of information requires that explicit written trigger from the employer. It is not an automatic carbon copy situation.
Okay. Always look for the in writing requirement. Now, speaking of accounts that are just sitting around, what happens when an account is entirely abandoned?
The ghost accounts.
Right. The customer stops trading, they stop answering the phone, the statements start bouncing back in the mail. And here's where I usually try to step in and apply some grand federal logic.
Well, let's hear it.
I assume there is a master SEC rulebook that says, after precisely 36 months of inactivity, I hereby declare this account dormant by the powers of the federal government.
I love the theatrical voice, but it sounds incredibly official and you would be entirely wrong.
I had a feeling.
The process of turning over abandoned property is called escheatment. An escheatment is not governed by federal law or SEC mandate. It is entirely based on state law.
Wait, really? We have this massive, centralized federal apparatus for everything else in finance, but a debt account is handled by the states. Why?
It goes back to the foundational concepts of property rights in the United States, which have historically been the domain of the individual states.
So the state just steps in?
The state acts as the ultimate custodian of abandoned property for its citizens. But because of this, there is no single nationwide dormancy period, no universal deadline, and no federal remittance rule.
But how does a firm actually handle it?
It's an operational nightmare. We have 50 different states with 50 different unclaimed property laws.
That's absurd.
Some states say 3 years, some say five. The fundamental rule is that the firm must first attempt to contact the owner at their last known address.
Right, give them a chance.
If that fails, and the contact doesn't restore the owner's claim, then the specific rules of the applicable state take over.
So how do they test that?
For the exam, if they want you to calculate a deadline, they will have to explicitly provide you with the state law facts in the question itself.
That is wild. 50 different rule books for lost money.
Okay, so we've built the legal shell of the account. We've maintained the records. We haven't surrendered the money to the wrong state government.
It's a miracle. Let's move to the actual treasure inside the account, the vault. Specifically, retirement funds. What are the 2026 retirement limits?
Let's do a rapid rundown. For traditional and Roth IRAs, they share a combined standard limit of $7,500.
Combined. So I can't put $7,500 into a traditional to get the tax deduction and another $7,500 into a Roth to get tax-free growth in the same year.
Correct. Your total aggregate contribution across both types of IRAs cannot exceed $7,500.
What if I'm older?
If you were age 50 or older, the IRS allows you an additional $1,100 catch-up contribution.
Okay, bringing the total to $8,600.
Exactly.
That's the standard retail IRA. But I'm going to push back here because the real world is more complicated. What if someone doesn't use an IRA?
Like an employer plan.
Right. What if they work for a state or local government, like a firefighter or a public school teacher, and they have a 457B plan?
The 457B. This is where the math gets very particular, and it's highly testable.
Lay it on me.
The standard limit for a 457B is $24,500.
Yeah.
But the catch-up provision is tricky because there are two different ways to calculate it.
Two ways?
Yeah. If you are 50 or older, you get a standard $8,000 catch-up. However, if the specific plan allows it, there is a special formula that applies during the last 3 years before normal retirement age.
Oh, interesting.
And that special formula can sometimes yield a much higher number.
So if a firefighter is 55, they might qualify for the age-based catch-up and the last 3 years catch-up. Which one do they use? Do they get to stack them?
No stacking. The rule is strictly you use whichever is greater. You calculate the age-based limit, you calculate the special last 3 years formula, and the participant is allowed to use the higher amount.
So the exam will test if I know that.
The exam will absolutely test if you know to choose the greater of the two.
What's fascinating to me is how these limits interact with income, specifically on the Roth side. Because if you make too much money, your ability to contribute to a Roth gets phased out.
Right. The government wants its cut.
The government doesn't want billionaires using tax-free wrappers. But there is a bizarre, highly specific phase-out rule for married people.
Oh, the MFS trap.
If you are married filing separately and you lived with your spouse at any point during the year, your Roth phase-out window is severely restricted. It is an incredibly tiny window, just $0 to $10,000.
It is remarkably low, and there's a very specific mechanism behind why they do that. Imagine a couple that makes $300,000 combined.
Okay, doing well for themselves.
If they file jointly, they make way too much to contribute to a Roth.
Right, they're totally phased out.
So a clever accountant might say, hey, let's have you file separately. One spouse makes $250K, but the other spouse only makes $50K. The lower earning spouse can now sneak under the income limits and fund a Roth.
That's sneaky.
The IRS saw this loophole and slammed it shut. If you are married, live together, but file separately, they phase out your Roth contribution ability almost immediately. If you make $11,000, you are already completely phased out. It is essentially a punitive measure to prevent income manipulation.
That makes total sense when you explain the mechanism. They're stopping high earners from hiding their combined wealth.
Exactly.
Compare that $10,000 limit to a single filer whose phase out doesn't even start until $153,000. It's a massive penalty.
Huge penalty.
Okay, so we've put the money in, we've navigated the limits, but eventually the government wants its tax money, which means the money has to come out. Required minimum distributions, RMDs. What is the baseline rule?
The baseline rule is that the tax man's patience eventually runs out. For traditional IRAs, SEP IRAs, simple IRAs, and 401ks, all of which were funded with pre-tax money, you have required minimum distributions.
You have to start taking it.
At a certain age, you must start withdrawing a minimum amount every single year so the government can finally tax it.
But this is a massive exam trap. What about Roth accounts?
Roth IRAs, and under recent legislation, this now includes Roth SEPs and Roth Simples, have no required minimum distributions before the original owner's death.
None at all, because the taxes were already paid before the money went in, right?
Exactly. The government already got their cut on the front end, so they aren't impatient to force it out on the back end. The beneficiary rules only kick in after the original owner dies and passes the account on.
So if I have a Roth SEP, I can just let it sit there and grow tax-free until I die, and the IRS won't bother me for an RMD.
Nope, you're good.
But if I have a traditional account and I'm subject to an RMD, there is another critical logistical trap. Can I take my required minimum distribution and just roll it over into a different retirement account to avoid the taxes?
Absolutely not. An required minimum distribution cannot be rolled over. An RMD is not considered an eligible rollover distribution.
So no dodging.
You must satisfy the required distribution amount first, meaning you take the cash and you pay the income tax on it. And only after that RMD is fully satisfied can you roll over any remaining eligible funds in the account.
Right.
You cannot dodge the tax man by rolling an RMD.
Pay the piper first, move the rest later. Speaking of moving money, let's introduce our final character for today. We have Frank the founder, diligent Dave, and now we have forgetful Fiona.
Hello, Fiona.
Fiona is retired, and she wants to move her IRA from one bank to another bank across town that offers better mutual funds. There are two distinct ways to move this money, a transfer or a rollover. And the exam will test you mercilessly on the difference.
Because the rules and the risks are wildly different.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison. First, the transfer. A trustee-to-trustee transfer.
In a trustee-to-trustee transfer, Fiona never touches the money. The old bank wires the money directly to the new bank.
It's all behind the scenes.
The funds move institution to institution. Because Fiona never has constructive receipt of the cash, there is no risk of her spending it.
Right.
Therefore, there is no time limit to complete it, and there are absolutely no limits on how many times per year she can do it. She could do a trustee-to-trustee transfer every single Tuesday if she wanted to.
It's frictionless because she never holds the bag. But a rollover is a totally different beast.
It is.
Okay, listener, here's another scenario. Let's say Fiona takes a physical check from her old IRA, cashes it into her checking account, and plans to write a new check to fund the new IRA herself. How many days does she have?
Think about the clock here.
Take a second. All right, what happens?
This is a customer-received rollover. Fiona now has the money in her hands. As soon as she does, the IRS gets nervous that she's just going to spend it or use it as an interest-free loan.
Yeah, buy a boat or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So two massive restrictions instantly apply. First, the 60-day rule. She has exactly 60 days from the day she receives the funds to get it into the new account, or it counts as a taxable distribution, plus potential early withdrawal penalties.
60 days, ticking clock. What's the second restriction?
The frequency limit. She is subject to a strict one-per-year limit. And that is one rolling 365-day period across all her IRAs in aggregate, not per account.
All of them combined.
If she does one customer-received rollover today, she cannot do another one for a full year.
Okay, so transfer equals infinite, rollover equals once a year with a 60-day clock. But here is where I'm going to try to trick you, just like the exam will.
Try me.
What if Fiona is retiring and she is moving money from an employer plan, like a 401k, directly into her retail IRA? Is she hit with that strict one per year limit?
She is not. A direct rollover from an employer plan to an eligible retirement plan does not face the one per year limit.
Why? It has the word rollover right in the name.
Because the limit strictly applies to IRA to IRA rollovers, where the customer receives the funds. A 401k or a 403b employer plan is not an IRA.
Ah, I see.
Therefore, moving money out of the corporate world and into the retail IRA world is exempt from that specific one per year restriction.
That's a huge loophole. Why do they allow it?
The IRS is trying to stop people from serially bouncing money between their personal IRAs to float themselves short-term cash. Emptying out a 401k when you retire is a different mechanism entirely.
That distinction, the WHY behind the rule, is exactly what separates a pass from a fail on this exam. Understanding that the IRS is trying to prevent short-term interest-free loans explains the 60-day limit and the one-per-year limit perfectly.
It really does. If you know the logic, you don't even have to memorize the rule.
All right, let's change the energy here. We have covered a massive amount of ground. We've walked through the front door with the CIP. We built the paper trail with the account info and KYC.
We survived the clocks.
We monitored the clocks and the employees, and we broke into the vault to move some retirement funds. Let's lock this in for exam day. It is time for the rapid fire recap. 7 top testable takeaways.
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Point 1, identifying the customer. The TIN application exception is the only way to open an account without an ID number already in hand, and you must confirm they applied before the account is opened.
Point 2, categorizing the account. Prime brokerage is a clearing and settlement arrangement, a service to consolidate margin and custody. It is not a distinct customer type, and it can serve both retail and institutional clients.
Point 3, record retention. The bouncer versus the membership file. CIP identity records are kept for 5 years. Account information records are kept for 6 years.
Point 4, paperwork and authority. Account acceptance, which requires a firm principal or manager's signature, is totally separate from transacting authority, which simply designates who the customer allows to trade on their behalf.
Point 5, our friend Diligent Dave and outside employee accounts. If it's a new account, you need prior written consent. If it's an existing account from before they were hired, they have 30 days to get consent and notify the outside firm. And duplicate statements only happen if requested in writing.
Point 6, the vault. Roth IRAs, and importantly Roth SIPs and Roth Simples, have no required minimum distributions before the original owner's death because the taxes were paid up front.
And finally, point 7, forgetful Fiona. The strict one-per-year rollover limit only applies to customer-received IRA to IRA rollovers. It does not apply to trustee transfers or direct rollovers from an employer plan.
It's a nice recap. You know, if we connect all of this to the bigger picture, we have this incredibly advanced digital financial system.
Yeah.
Operations teams are settling complex trades in fractions of a second across the globe using massive fiber optic networks.
It's basically magic.
Yet for processes like escheatment, when an account simply goes dormant, we are entirely bound by 50 different, sometimes archaic, state laws drafted decades ago.
It's crazy.
As you study this material, ask yourself, as finance becomes increasingly borderless, instantaneous, and digital, how long can the industry sustain a state-by-state patchwork for things like abandoned property?
That is a brilliant and slightly maddening question to chew on while you're reviewing your flashcards. The contrast between light-speed trading and state-level bureaucracy is wild. All right. That is our deep dive into the hidden plumbing of Wall Street operations.
It's been fun.
Remember the bouncer, the bartender, and our friends Frank, Dave, and Fiona. You've got the concepts, you know the traps, and you know the why behind the rules. Go crush that exam. See you next time.